This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In a moment, we talk about the past and future of our incredibly popular state and national parks on their 100th anniversary. First, though, a status report on the ongoing confrontation between North Carolina and the federal government over HB 2. As you know, the U.S. Justice Department believes the bill violates both Title 9 and Title 7 of the Civil Rights Act, as well as the Violence Against Women Act, and had given the state until yesterday to promise not to enforce the law. But yesterday, Governor Pat McCrory responded by filing a lawsuit seeking a court opinion on the Justice Department's allegations. Hours later, the Justice Department filed suit against the state based on the contentions I just mentioned.
You have been told that this law protects vulnerable populations from harm, but that is just not the case. Instead, what this law does is inflict further indignity on a population that has already suffered far more than its fair share. This action is about a great deal more than bathrooms. This is about the dignity and the respect that we accord our fellow citizens and the laws that we as a people and as a country have enacted to protect them. Indeed, to protect all of us.
And our legislature also filed suit against the federal government yesterday. And joining us to talk about all of this is WFAE's Tom Bullock. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
So now we have, I don't know the word, the paper said dueling lawsuits, but when you have three parties.
Is it dueling lawsuits? I'm not exactly sure, yeah.
So the state's suing the feds are suing the state, which. What is each side arguing?
Well, let's start with Governor Pat McCrory's suit. He was the first to file a lawsuit yesterday, and he had until close of business yesterday to give some kind of response to the Department of Justice letter that you spoke about. The governor states pretty straightforward that he thinks that this is government overreach, that the definition, and all of this is going to break down to a simple definition, the definition of the word sex. Do you believe that it is a biological trait? Do you believe that it is really, in essence, a matter of plumbing? Or is it something that is mental? Is it something that happens as much, you know, in your mind as it would, as they say, between your legs? So the governor asks a federal judge in the Eastern District of North Carolina to rule whether or not House Bill 2's bathroom provisions discriminates based on sex, based on whether or not the, sex is a protected class in federal law. The Justice Department says, well, LGBT rights falls under sex in their purview. The governor wants a federal judge to decide if that is in fact valid.
And how does the governor's lawsuit differ from the legislature's lawsuit?
Actually, you know, I could make the joke that it's basically just who the plaintiff is, but there is a pretty significant way the two suits are different. Governor McCrory's lawsuit deals specifically with Title VII and the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Title VII is about employment discrimination. And he also brings up a counter charge about the Violence Against Women Act, which was amended in the 2000s to include protections for LGBT individuals. But you'll notice I didn't say Title IX there. Title IX really is the crux of this, the DOJ lawsuit against North Carolina and in particular the university system, because Title IX deals with discrimination in educational settings. So the governor doesn't touch Title IX. And interestingly, yesterday in his press conference, he said that the University of North Carolina system is more or less on their own. And today the Board of Governors are meeting to actually discuss about what the response is going to be. Now the legislative leaders bring up all three. They bring up Title VII, again, that's employment discrimination, Title IX, which is education discrimination, and the Violence Against Women Act. So that's a pretty significant difference between the two.
And at his press conference yesterday, the governor also took the stand that North Carolina and the rest of the nation need clarification on federal law.
Our nation is one nation, especially when it comes to fighting discrimination, which I support wholeheartedly. Ultimately, I think it's time for the U.S. Congress to bring clarity to our national anti-discrimination provisions under Title VII and Title IX.
Later in her press conference yesterday that I watched on television, Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, basically said the law as written is very clear. Case law that has been developed through court cases that have challenged these laws is also very clear. This is a case of discrimination. Pure and simple.
But everything when it comes to lawsuits is a matter of interpretation by the court. I mean, it really is that simple. Yes, there is precedent. The most recent case was last month when the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals.
She cited that.
Yep, she did. it's a case dealing with a transgender high school student in Virginia, and they sent the Fourth Circuit sent, you know, a lower, basically sent the plaintiff back saying you can indeed sue for discrimination for not being allowed to use the restroom and locker room of your choice. It's not as clear cut as sometimes it can seem. It is precedent, but it wasn't a defining character. It wasn't a defining case yet.
You said something on last Friday's news roundup that I don't think people have heard very loud and clear. I had never heard it before. And it had to do with the Title IX monies, which amount to about $2 billion, give or take a couple of hundred thousand here or there, maybe a couple million here or there. And it does affect the university system, and it does affect the school systems throughout the state.
Correct.
You said, if I understood you correctly, that this is not connected to any lawsuits. The administration can cut these funds off at will.
They can. I mean, when it comes down to it, it is a federally administered program that is administered by the executive branch. So an executive order by the president or a decision by the U.S. Justice Department could indeed cut off that funding. However, just because they can doesn't mean they will. And in history, looking at history, they haven't yet. So it is a real threat, but it wouldn't just be, as you said, with a snap of your fingers.
So
it wouldn't be quite that quick.
It would be in the best interest, one would assume, for when the University of North Carolina Board of Governors meets today, for them to do what?
Well, they're going to have to walk a pretty fine line. You know, Margaret Spellings, who's the new head of the UNC system, has said straight up that she sees the university is very much stuck in the middle of this fight. They have to follow state law. House Bill 2 is state law. They also have to follow federal guidance and federal law when it comes to federal funding. So they're not really sure exactly. I'm very curious to see what she has to say. But here's the thing. Note in her press conference that Loretta Lynch, the U.S. Attorney General, never did bring up the fact that they were going to cut off federal funding. That's an important point because it is basically the nuclear option in a situation like this. Because if you go back and you look at Brown versus Board of Education, a case that was decided by the Supreme Court years and years prior to actual desegregation taking place, right? It was the federal funding that finally flipped the switch. When the states were looking at a loss of federal funding, a true, complete loss of federal funding, that is when they finally moved and started to fall in compliance with federal law.
Did the governor have other options yesterday, and do you think his lawsuit was coordinated with the legislatures?
Huh, it's a really interesting question. I don't know if it was coordinated or not because, frankly, Phil Berger and Tim Moore and the governor could have easily just combined into one single lawsuit. Why is there a difference between the two? Why does the governor's case leave out Title IX and the legislative leaders include it? I really don't know. There is no love in Raleigh between the governor's mansion and the General Assembly building. We all know that. We've all reported on that. I don't know if it was necessarily coordinated. Now, what was the other part of that question?
Did he have other options?
Well, he did have other options. He could have easily just basically said, we're not going to enforce House Bill 2, which is what the U.S. Justice Department had asked the state to decide. Now, I say that that's easy because you could, in theory, just put out an order, which it was much simpler, much more efficient use of time, shall we say, than a lawsuit. But that doesn't mean that it is the right decision. And so for the governor, especially during what's looking to be an incredibly tough election year, I think really he wants this fight. He believes that this is government overreach. And so for him, this was his best choice.
And finally, any way to predict how the courts may react to these two suits, these three suits actually? And do they have to be the same? What if they're not? What if the decisions are not the same?
How long have you been in this business? You know nobody can predict a federal judge.
But I have to ask the question.
No, you do have to ask. And there's a good point here. No, I mean, we don't even know timeline yet. Like, obviously, you're going to see something likely expedited. But here's an interesting twist. We talk about these three federal suits. You may think that all three were filed in the same federal court, and they weren't. So you literally have three different cases filed in two different federal courts that cover three different laws and ask for the same end goal. Is sex
– is that purposeful?
I don't think it's necessarily purposeful. I think it actually – the jurisdictions for the courts I think makes sense in this case. The lawmakers and Governor McCrory basically filed in – I won't get into the minutiae of it, but I do think that it makes sense. I don't think it was purposeful. But you have – two different federal judges now that will decide. One will decide Title VII and the Violence Against Women Act and whether or not sex is a protected class that includes LGBT individuals. Another one's going to be looking at all three, which would include Title VII, Title IX, and Violence Against Women Act. And then you have, you know, the flip side. Those are two from the state side, and then you'll have the federal complaint as well.
Could this make its way to the Supreme Court, one of these cases, or all of these cases?
Well,
split Supreme Court.
I don't think that you're going to see all three of these cases make it to the Supreme Court, because if it gets to that point, when it gets to that point, they would be consolidated into some kind of general thing. But do I think that you could see more than one of these? We could see a split decision, and then it goes to the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Yeah, that is a possible outcome.
Well, one thing we're learning: in the bathroom, there's never a dull moment. Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. This year, both our state and national parks celebrate their centennial. In those 100 years, state and federal officials have not only successfully preserved hundreds of thousands of acres of natural area, but have opened them to the public for recreational purposes. And the public has taken to our parks like moths to a flame. Last year, parks here and around the country experienced record-setting attendance. We love our parks so much that some fear that we are loving them to death. So this hour, we look at the parks, their past, present, and future, and we're joined by Mike Murphy, Director of State Parks, and he joins us from studios at WUNC in Durham. Good morning, Mike. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And in our studio are Larry Hyde and Dewey Matherly. Mr. Hyde is superintendent of Crowder's Mountain State Park, and Mr. Matherly is president of Friends of Crowder's Mountain. That's a citizens group. Welcome to both of you. Morning.
Morning.
Mike, how did it come to be that both North Carolina's park system and the national park system came into being at nearly the same time 100 years ago? How did that happen?
Well, that's a really good question. Nobody's ever asked me that before. Well, of course, the National Park Service, there were national parks before 100 years ago. For instance, Yosemite had been around already. So the National Park Service, their anniversary really is about this park service, a consolidation of some other groups, I think. For us, it is when we created the very first state park in North Carolina, and indeed the first state park in the southeastern United States at Mount Mitchell.
That's the very first one in the whole southeast?
Very first one.
That was March.
It was kind of an interesting story because Governor Locke Craig had been asked to make a speech kind of congratulating the timber companies for building a new railroad up the mountain. And he had grown up in western North Carolina and had remembered what it was. But when he got there to make this speech, he looked up and looked around and thought, oh, my, this has gone too far. And so he and some other folks in the western part of the state went back to Raleigh and said, told the General Assembly, we've got a huge problem here. We need to save this mountain. Mount Mitchell is the tallest mountain east of the Black Hills of South Dakota. So it's an important place. It was important for the state to know that it was the tallest mountain because for tourism purposes. So the General Assembly agreed with Governor Locke Craig, gave him $20,000, and they went out and bought about 795 acres, about $25 an acre.
And that was a March 3rd, 1915, which makes it 101 years ago, I suppose. We're going to talk.
Well, that was when the legislation was.
We're going to talk more about our state parks and about Crowder's Mountain and what's going on there. The most crowded state park in the state, I believe, Crowder's Mountain. Crowded State Park is what they're going to call it in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Treliant Federal Credit Union, a member-owned, not-for-profit community credit union, 12 Charlotte area locations, including Ballantyne, Steel Creek, and Park Road. Treliant, life improved. Details at Treliant.org. Well, no matter what you may think about the GOP's presumptive nominee, Donald Trump, his success has been remarkable, and many commentators have tried to explain that success by crediting those who feel disenfranchised. But Bloomberg's Virginia Postrell has a different theory, glamour. She believes Trump is selling a glamorous lifestyle, a brand that actually represents the American dream. We're going to hear more about this from her tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Republicans now control the Senate, but a handful of competitive races around the country could flip, giving control back to the Democrats. Close Senate races in 2016 and what Donald Trump's candidacy could mean for down-ballot races.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about the state parks on their 100th birthday, give or take a couple of months, with Mike Murphy, who is the director of state parks, Larry Hyde, superintendent of Crowder's Mountain State Park, and Dewey Motherly, who is president of Friends of Crowder's Mountain. We talked about the first state park in the system, which is Mount Mitchell, signed into law in 1915. That was the first state park, as you said, Mike, in the southeastern United States, and now it is one of how many state parks in North Carolina?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's not as easy as you might believe. So we have 75 units in the state park system. So there are 35 state parks, 4 state recreation areas, 20 state natural areas, 7 state lakes, 5 state trails, and 4 state rivers. So I think if you're trying to really break that down, I would say that there are 40 manned units that are kind of park-like, because the recreation areas are very similar to parks in some ways. And some of the state natural areas, 2 of them are very park-like. So I would say 40 units.
Wow.
Although one of the parks really is more of a state natural area.
It sounds like a lot. Is that a lot for a state this size?
230,000 acres, I would say that we are very blessed relative to our contemporaries across the country. We are really, in many ways, the envy of our my brother state park directors.
Hmm. Let me bring a citizen in here, not a park employee, Dewey Motherly, who's president of Friends of Crowder's Mountain. It has been said of the national parks that they are America's best idea. Could the same be said of our state parks?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'm the best person to speak to
that. Well, you're just an ordinary citizen. You don't work for the parks.
And I definitely don't work for the federal government either. So there you go. I would have to say that it really opens doors to people who are often in larger areas, city areas, that want a place to get away. And so without that, I think that would just be a tremendous loss. Mm-hmm. I've talked with people. I'm on the trails. I walk the parks, not just Crowder's, but others throughout the state. And one of my favorites is down at Fort Macon. So I visit a lot of these parks. And I've talked with people who say, you know, I love coming here. I've lost 60 pounds just coming here to walk. And so I'm not sure where they would get that if they didn't have the state parks. If you look at, like, municipalities and cities that have their own park area, they're not as expansive. They don't give them as much opportunity to do other things in the state parks. They can do rock climbing. They can do boating, fishing. I mean, they have lots and lots of different opportunities. So, I think they're wonderful, and it's a great opportunity.
Let me ask the same question of a partisan, a person who works for the park system. And you've worked for the parks for a long time, Larry Hyde, right?
I've worked for the state park system since 1992.
Wow. So that's a long time. Is this the best idea the state's ever had in your mind?
I think so. In the case of the park that I'm at right now, Crowder's Mountain State Park, a lot of times it's considered an urban oasis. Mm-hmm. It gives probably the largest base of citizens in North Carolina the chance to get a rugged outdoor experience within an hour, maybe an hour and a half drive. A lot of folks that come to Crowder's Mountain are actually training for more rigorous experiences, maybe in the national parks, maybe even across the ocean. A lot of folks talk about training for Kilimanjaro and for other adventures. And
you have 2 trails that are rated rigorous. I don't know who rates them, but it's not for the faint of heart, these 2 trails, evidently.
We actually have about 4 or 5 that are considered what we call strenuous.
Okay.
Based partly on the topography, the elevation gain, but also the ruggedness, the rockiness of them, the fact that you have to watch where you're stepping. You get more of an experience that you would get on some of these mountain peaks, but yet you don't have to go that far from where you live.
This whole state park system, as we said, began in 1915 with the incorporation of Mount Mitchell as the first state park. The next time that North Carolina bought land for a park, I understand, was 1969. That's a big interval when they purchased the land that is now Carolina Beach State Park. Does that mean that most of the land for the state park system has been donated over the years, Mike Murphy?
Absolutely. It is historically, most parks up until then were started through some sort of grassroots organization that wanted to contribute land for a park. I should point out that that same time, Raven Rock also was the same year as Carolina Beach has been the first one using state funds. So $20,000 was invested at Mount Mitchell. They did invest a dollar at Fort Macon and a dollar at Umstead.
What did they spend it on? Cotton candy? What did they spend the dollar on?
A dollar won't get you much cotton candy these days. But so it's been, those were incredible bargains, and we felt very fortunate to have gotten those. Mm. So Morrill Mountain, for instance, another one not far from Charlotte, was also a grassroots movement and was, in fact, one of our very first state parks. So you had Mount Mitchell was first, then Fort Macon. Mm-hmm. Morrill Mountain, I believe, was third.
You know, it's hard to believe, but some have criticized the federal government for having too much parkland. And recently, a Utah congressman offered a bill to block presidents from using the Antiquities Act to expand parklands because he views that as an end run around Congress, and that too much land that could be used for development and mining and other efforts is being tied up by the federal government. Would anyone level that same criticism at North Carolina?
Well, so to start a new state park unit has to be authorized by the General Assembly. To add land to an existing unit does not require that.
Mm-hmm.
And we constantly are doing that, but we're talking about small pieces. I think over the last few years we've averaged somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 acres a year, so it's not huge amounts. But it does allow us to fill in holes or inholdings, that sort of thing, or add on to something that we really wanted years ago but was not available.
And you've been working to add land to our parks.
We do.
Are you adding? Are you doing what you just talked about, adding parcels to already existing parks, or are you also trying to create new parks?
Well, right now our goal is to fill in the existing park system. We call this our path forward. And, for instance, the Connect NC bond issue has $14 million for us to buy land in the state parks for the state parks. So right now we think those will be adding on pieces to existing units. Mm-hmm. We don't currently have a target, if you will, for a new state park. But having said that, if an opportunity came up where we could make acquire a large enough property to do that, we would certainly look at that. But for the most part, we're trying to fill in. We had, since 1980, we've had 18 new units to the state park system, and we really need to kind of finish up those properties in terms of land acquisition. So that's where our focus is right now.
Mike Murphy is director of the state parks. Larry Hyde is also with us. He's superintendent of Crowder's Mountain State Park. And Mike talked a minute ago about how the first park in the system came to be, Mount Mitchell. It was a speech that the governor was going to make to laud the lumbering industry for coming in and cutting out the timber. And he discovered that, oh, my gosh, we've gone too far. We need to preserve this land, and did. Crowder's Mountain became a state park in part, I'm told, to protect it from mining and development interests. Talk about that, Larry.
That is correct. In 1971, there was kind of a dual effort taking part, or at least the most visible effort was two-sided. An organization called the Gaston Conservation Society developed to try to encourage the legislature to purchase this land. And then on October 30th, 1971, the Gaston Ecology Club led a protest march about 4 miles from the park that led to what's now known as the Linwood Access Area, which is the main area to get up Crowder's Mountain. And one of the signs there that was carried in that typical protest-type march of the time was it said Earth's Last Stand. Mm. And the primary purpose was that Crowder's Mountain was being looked at for strip mining for several different minerals, including kyanite. And there was an example not too far down the road of what could happen if strip mining was taken to the extreme, and that's just across the state line near Clover, South Carolina, yeah. an area called Henry's Knob. So those efforts worked together both to get local interest but also to convince the legislature of the value of protecting this incredible resource.
Could that happen today in this environment, this political environment?
I do think it could happen today. Mm-hmm. If we had an important enough resource that maybe wasn't on the radar yet, but the local folks realized the value of it, I do think it could certainly happen again.
You started your association with state parks as a park ranger, I think in 1992, you said.
Yeah.
But you also have a degree in park administration and natural resource management. What do you know about parks, our parks in particular, that perhaps most of us don't know?
I've visited most all the parks in the North Carolina State Park System, except for a couple. We have probably the most varied system that I can imagine, and I'm actually from California, which has a pretty varied system. But we have a variety of natural features, the highest areas, the lowest points near the ocean, but the historical significant areas such as Fort Macon, the cultural areas that we have with a lot of American Indian development as well as European development. And then you have more developed facilities such as at Mora Mountain, the effort that the WPA and the CCC did to create cabins and swimming pools, mm-hmm. more developed features. And then you have areas that basically are just wide open wild in different parks. So I think we just have the best variety you could possibly get.
Dewey Motherly mentioned hiking. A lot of people do go hiking on Crowder's Mountain and in other parts of our park system, but they also ski, they canoe, they picnic, they fish, they camp. What seems to be the most popular activity that most people involve themselves in our state park?
There's been quite a few studies on this, actually, and the overwhelming majority of folks come to a state park to hike or to walk.
You want to chime in on that, Mike?
Well, that's exactly right. Okay. Hiking is the overwhelming favorite activity. And that's why we are a hiking system. We have every park has numerous trails, and we even have state trails, as I said, five of them, including the Mountains to Sea Trail, which is a multi-generational project that starts at Clingman's Dome on the Tennessee border and goes all the way to Jockey's Ridge. And so we are a hiking system from the word go, no question about it.
Are any of these parks part of the so-called Carolina Thread Trail that's being developed?
Well, the Carolina Thread Trail is a series of trails in the Charlotte metropolitan area. And we connect onto a variety of trails, but not directly. And Larry, you can probably tell me if anything connects up to Crowder's, but for instance, Carolina Thread Trail does not connect to the mountains. The Sea Trail does not connect to any of the other state trails, but it is an important trail system, and a lot of people have put in some good work to create it.
You were nodding vigorously, Dewey, when I mentioned the Carolina Thread Trail, so what's your point of view on that?
Well, it does have a connection to Crowder's, so there are some trails in Crowder's that connect up with that, along with some other trails in the area, including the Gateway Trail out of Kings Mountain, which is to connect to the Crowder's Trails as well. So what we're doing is really giving people a lot of options, a lot of opportunities to start from point A and go to point B and make it a really enjoyable process and see a lot of different things all over the state. So I think it's just a great connection.
I mentioned in the beginning that both the national and the state park systems in the last several years have experienced record-setting attendance. To what do you attribute this surge in interest in these parks?
Well, I think that part of it is because we've been talking about the centennial, to be honest. I mean, we have certainly noticed in recent the last 2 years a large increase, 17 million plus last year. This year, we're probably going to exceed that by a substantial margin unless we have some weather events. So I think that's part of it. I think part of it is that people recognize that this is a place of, that is inexpensive because the state park system is free for the most part. Just to enter a state park is free. Some of the reservoirs in the central part of the state, Jordan Lake, Falls Lake, and Carr Lake, do have entry fees during the summer and during the shoulder season weekends. But for the most part, all the state parks are free. And that's a great thing. People can just drive to their local state park, go in for a couple hours and come out and not have to spend a dime. And I think that as time has gone on, people become more aware of that. So we're very very pleased about that. And I hear all the time how excited people are that our state park system is free.
And Crowder's Mountain has really surged in popularity.
Really?
In the last 2 years, you've gone from 350,000 in attendance to 677,000 in annual attendance. Do you expect that number to be surpassed this year?
Right now, our current projection for 2016 is to break 800,000.
Wow. Which brings up Andy's email question, who says, when are you going to add more parking more parking at Crowder's Mountain State Park? That is evidently an increasing problem for people. They get there and they can't park.
That is a very good question. Thanks to the governor's initiative and the legislature approving it, and then the voters of North Carolina.
As well as the voters, yeah.
Yeah, the bonds.
The voters deciding it, part of the the Connect NC bond will definitely impact in a positive way Crowder's Mountain State Park, in that Crowder's Mountain will get $750,000 of that specifically to improve visitor access, specifically by adding parking.
Well, is the attendance? Mike mentioned that is because you're promoting the centennial of the parks, that's raising awareness of the parks, creating more interest. People are coming. Is that what's going on at Crowder's, or is it the fact that the area is growing so rapidly? More people are coming in. They're looking to, even though they want to live in an urban area, they want to get out of the urban area for recreational purposes. What's going on? What do you think is happening?
I think there's a variety of factors. One of them is certainly the increased urbanization and the desire, when you have time off, to be able to get away from the urbanization in a positive way, which I believe you get that at Crowder's Mountain. It can be difficult on the weekends because there's a lot of folks doing that. I also think there's a little bit of a social media part to this, and I'll explain. I believe that the fact that in real time you can tell your friends and all your followers – where you are,
you can Instagram your selfie.
Exactly. It's no longer you go back and you talk about where you were on the weekend. You can tell them in real time and say, come join me up here on top of the mountain.
Wow. We'll come back and talk more about that in a second with Larry Hyde, superintendent of Crowder's Mountain State Park, Dewey Motherly, who's president of Friends of Crowder's Mountain. We'll talk about that organization as well, and Mike Murphy, director of State Parks. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nantahala Outdoor Center, offering 8 whitewater rafting trips in the southeast. More at noc.com. Well, North Carolina and the Department of Justice are suing each other, as you've heard on this program, over the controversial HB 2, House Bill 2. The state wants a court ruling on whether sex discrimination laws include gender identity. The federal government says the state law violates the Civil Rights Act. Governor McCrory says this has become a national issue, and evidently he is right, because they'll be talking about all this in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. We, by the way, are putting together another voter roundtable for Charlotte Talks, and we want you to be involved. Get in touch with our producers and tell them a little bit about yourself. You can find out more about all this at WFAE.org. And we are coming right back.
You think you're frustrated with the uncertainty around what your healthcare costs? Join the club.
The problem in the U.S., bluntly speaking, is there's no transparency around what the real prices of everything is.
we need to do something about that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. That was the CEO of the pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline. You can hear more next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about our state park system on their 100th birthday with the director of state parks, Mike Murphy, Larry Hyde, superintendent of Crowder's Mountain State Park, and Dewey Matherly. Not Motherly, Matherly. I guess I just gave you that name because of your gentle Ben appearance over here. Dewey Matherly is the president of Friends of Crowder's Mountain. And we've asked a social media question. You were talking about social media a second ago. We asked what people enjoy about our state parks, and you can share your comments with us on Twitter at Charlotte Talks or on Facebook or email for that matter. When we were talking about social media, Dewey, you said you believe that there's more to it than even just that.
Yeah, I think that just nationally, groups are promoting health and fitness. And that's an easy, cheap way to get healthy is by using your state park. And I think a lot of people say, you know, if I go out, if I can walk in a natural area instead of on a treadmill or something, it's much more enjoyable. I can do it. It's close. It's quick. It's easy. Not easy necessarily some of the walks, but easy to get to, easy to get in and out of. I think that really improves the numbers.
So we have a lot of newcomers in our listening area because people are flooding into this area every single day. So what is the draw at Crowder's Mountain? And I want you to undersell it because you don't need any more people up there. What is the draw?
Some of those trails are really hard to climb. Yeah.
Crowder's Mountain State Park has the highest peak, certainly, in the Piedmont region, south of the Appalachian Mountains. We also have probably the most undisturbed portion of property outside of the visitors, again, in that region. If you go down Interstate 85 towards South Carolina and you see a mountain range, that entire mountain range is the park. So there's a big draw to get to the summit to be able to see where you came from, basically.
So is attendance – I know we talked about attendance increasing at Crowder's Mountain State Park. Is it increasing at the same rate as the rest of the state parks or at a much higher – noticeably higher rate than the rest of the state parks?
In the last couple of years, and Mike Murphy might have more specific numbers, in the last couple of years we probably have grown more than most state parks. I believe this year we're actually right on pace with the other state parks. Is that correct, Mike?
So Crowder's, the visitation was up about 17% between 14 and 15. The numbers I have, and these are preliminary at this point, indicate that up about 22% this year relative to the same period last year, whereas the whole entire system might be a little bit greater than that, but not much. So clearly it is in the same category. We were up 11% as a system last year, so certainly things were faster at Crowder's. I would look at one of the other things I would look at is if you track our visitation since 1990, we were at about 9.5 million in 1990. And at that time, our population was, I think, 6.6 million. And now we are very close to 10 million in population, and we're getting, we had 17 million last year. We will exceed that this year, assuming we don't have any huge weather problems. And so I would say that the multiplier, so the state is growing, but we're also growing faster than the state is growing.
Wow. So this all sounds like great news. And if you were a corporation, this would be terrific news, and we'd be having dividends being paid to stockholders, and the price of the shares would be going up like no tomorrow. But this is not necessarily good news, because along with all these people come problems. Before we talk about the problems, talk to me about how people are in those parks. Are they good? Are the visitors to these parks, the visitors to Crowder's Mountain and other parks, good stewards of the park?
In general,
one of the things that we do. Let me do this, and then Larry, I'd love you to add on to it.
Okay.
One of the three parts of our mission, in addition to conservation and recreation, is education. And so a big part of what we do is we're trying to educate our visitors about environmental stewardship. They understand what the natural processes were that are at work at this at any given park. And I think that that's helping them becoming personally better stewards as visitors of our parks. Now, when you have 17, 18, whatever number it turns out to be this year, million people, that is going to create trash. It's going to create wear and tear on the facilities, on the trails. And we're working hard to keep that at bay, as you can well imagine. We have some ways to do that. We are fortunate to have the Parks and Recreation Trust Fund, which provides us with capital funds for renovation, major repairs, that sort of thing. Again, that's part of what we are paying taxes for, and is to maintain these parks.
And yet,
but it is a challenge, no mistake.
One of the things that your organization does is you have volunteers helping to clean up the litter in these parks. Right. Has that problem increased along with attendance? And is that because, if it has increased, because there are simply more people or because the people who are coming don't understand park etiquette?
You know, I don't have an honest answer for that, but I would say it's probably just with the numbers. I think a lot of people who...
So when you're picking up trash,
yeah.
What are you picking up?
Tissues, paper towels, wrappers from granola bars, those kinds of things.
Water bottles,
yeah. Uh-huh. And I think some of them, they are dropped accidentally, is what I'm saying.
Is that because there are insufficient receptacles for trash along the trails, or is it because it's just more convenient to drop it?
I think it's just accidental, a lot of it.
Okay.
I think people stick it back in their pack or in their pocket, and it falls out while they're hiking because they have to step differently or whatever, and it's not secured well.
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't even realize it until they get back and they go, oh, where did that bottle go?
Because, Larry, you're one of the people that say that we may be loving our parks to death. Is that what you're talking about, or is there more to it than that?
There certainly is a price to pay for the increased attendance. We have some very well-designed trails, but because of the sheer amount of foot traffic that are on them, they are getting worn out.
Talk to me about that, because, you know, it seems to me that trails are just paths. So how do they wear out? Explain it to me. I'm sure you're right, but I just don't understand
it. Well, there's several factors. One of them is the effect that the weather has, especially rain, especially heavy rains.
Right.
The other effect is the amount of foot traffic that takes place, especially after a rain event, because that's when they get the most erosion. If they're designed well, meaning they're designed to allow for runoff and they don't go up too steep a pass, generally the water's not a factor. And most of the trails that we have in the system have been designed to take care of that. However, when you're putting nearly a 500,000 people on the same trail, there's going to be an impact on that, whether the rain is an impact or not. Yeah. And I've specifically noticed that in the last 3 years.
Are most of these dirt trails, or do you pave some of them?
None of our trails in our park are paved. We do have some gravel trails, especially on the Linwood Access side. But even those areas with gravel have to have some improvements made every couple of years.
And also, I guess there's no way around this, but with more people, you're back in an urban environment. Even though you've gone to Crowder's Mountain to get away from it, there you are because you're surrounded by people.
Certainly on the weekends and holidays especially, that is a correct statement. At this point in time, any pretty day, you can expect that there will be a point where you'll have to come in and you won't actually be able to find a parking space.
Yeah.
You may have to wait. In extreme days, there are times we actually have to close the gates because not only is there no way to find you a place to park, there's nowhere to safely allow you to wait for a place to park. And what happens is it backs onto a very busy highway.
Is that specific to Crowder's Mountain, or is that happening at other parks around the state?
It is happening at a handful of other parks.
Mike?
Well, it does happen at different places. As you can imagine, 4th of July is a very busy time at, say, Jordan Lake, and sometimes the parking lots fill up, and that would be true for Falls Lake and some other places as well. It is an issue, and we're trying to walk this very fine line between keeping a place natural and filling it up with parking lots, because we could build lots and lots of parking lots across the state, and we could fill them no doubt. But what I think one of the things that would make sense and we would like to see is this year presents us an opportunity to show off some of the lesser visited parks, which are every bit as magnificent. Admittedly, they're not in Charlotte, they're not in Raleigh, they're not in Greensboro, but they're not far, and these are places people can get away. And I think that day of the week, as well as different locations, could create a situation where we could reduce some of the crowding in places like Crowder's or at the beach, and perhaps get people out to see something brand new and exciting that they didn't know was in part of our system.
One of the other challenges that overcrowding brings to the parks, and particularly to Crowder's Mountain, is that your rangers have stopped on some days giving nature programs because they're too busy directing traffic. Is there a way around that? Could Gaston County Highway Patrol or police be brought in to do that, to let the rangers do what they do?
This is a difficult situation to solve, but I think it's a two-part effort. It's one, us looking at different methods, maybe having shuttles, maybe having different methods to come to the park.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important the public to realize how busy the park could be during our peak times and maybe pick less busy times to come, to realize that.
When would be a less busy time? Middle of the week?
Generally, the weekdays are pretty good. It's mostly the weekends and holidays that we fill up, although on some of the college breaks we have filled up even on the weekdays. We do our best to let folks know when we are going to be busy. Mm-hmm. We use social media ourselves. We use Facebook and Twitter to alert folks when we're busy. We also use our website. I think at this point in time, just because of how many folks come to the park, it's good to plan your trip, meaning to maybe check and see how busy it might be that day. And like Mike Murphy said, maybe discover another treasure that may not be at Crowder's, but maybe somewhere else.
You know, it's really amazing when you think about it. This is a free natural resource, and it's not like exactly like Disney World, but you're getting those kinds of crowds all over the place. How do people find out about these other parks? How extensive is your web presence, Mike Murphy?
Well, we have a very extensive website. We're on Facebook. We are on Twitter. The website allows you to find out a lot about the parks. It'll give you alerts if there's an issue. Certainly Facebook and Twitter will give you the most immediate alerts to something. But the website is a really good one. It's been recently designed. We just finished it up last fall. With a complete redesign. So I certainly invite people to go there, www.ncparks.gov. It's beautifully done and provides a lot of information.
Now, one of the things
you can use it to get reservations for camping and other things.
One of the things that Friends of Crowder's Mountain does is to support the park and when the state doesn't have the money to do what needs to be done. So what has been the result of your support?
Well, we've been very fortunate. We've been able to get some grants that as a nonprofit we can write for that the park couldn't. One of the things we were able to get was a grant from REI to purchase a utility trailer and tools to use on work days. And it saves us about an hour each week that we go out to work each time because we don't have to load, unload, load, unload. They just go right in the trailer. We got a grant to provide some picnic tables for the Boulders Access Area, which is on the far end down toward the South Carolina end. So those kinds of things and donations from people have helped us to purchase other things at the park.
How big is your organization? How many members?
Right now, it's very small. We have about 22, I think, paying members.
Wow. And you've done all that with 22 people? And I know that you're looking for more people. And one of the things that I read was that you're looking for younger people because a lot of people who are volunteers are obviously probably retired, have time on their hands, want to do something. But you need younger people because you have some heavy lifting to do here, right?
Yes, please. So, absolutely. And there are a lot of benefits in doing it, but it does not take a lot of a person's time. We need people who care about the outdoors and the parks, who are willing to say, yeah, I'll give some of my time, and I'm not talking about a whole lot of time. We only meet four times a year. We help with the annual festival, which is usually in November. This year, it's going to be at the end of October, along with our centennial presentation. If they could give on an average, I'd say, of 1 to 2 hours a month is what it would come out to over 12 months, it would be a tremendous help.
So how do they reach you?
704-730-8295. Absolutely. It's there. It's open. It's available. Or they can do the Friends of Crowder's website as well.
I was going to say, I can't remember the last time somebody gave a phone number. Friends of Crowder's
And I do talk to people.
.org?
Yeah.
Okay. How many organizations like Dewey's are there out there helping the parks around the state, Michael?
So we have more than 30 Friends organizations. Not every state park has a Friends organization. We also have a statewide Friends organization, the Friends of State Parks, and then we have the Friends of the Mountains to Sea Trail. And so we have a lot of Friends organizations we have a lot of friends.
And a lot of visitors every year, and we need those friends because the visitors are wearing some of these parks down a little bit. And I want to point out before we run out of time that according to figures from 2007, which are the last year that I have figures for, the North Carolina Division of Parks and Recreation conducted a study which determined that the parks are significant contributors to North Carolina's economy, with visitors spending at least $139 million annually. I'm sure current figures would be higher than that. Mike Murphy's director of the state parks, Larry Hyde, superintendent of Crowder's Mountain State Park, and Dewey Matherly is president of Friends of Crowder's Mountain, and that's friendsofcrowders.org. And thank you all for the hour.